Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Today is the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. So a lot of us are thinking about that day, what it felt like, and the days that followed. Fairly quickly, the newspapers printed photographs of the 19 hijackers, nearly all Saudis, and it was later established that they'd been funded mostly by wealthy Saudis who were sympathetic to the Wahhabist interpretation of Islam that informs Al-Qaeda and a slightly different version that informs ISIS now. Well, at the time, I thought to myself, boy, it's a good thing Interpol exists, because they are going to need that international coordination of police departments and intelligence sources to track down the people behind this horrendous criminal act. And everybody seemed confident that we would definitely find them and bring them to justice. Or so it seemed. Unknown to the American public at that point, the inner circle of the Bush administration had a very different idea about how to frame what had happened and what to do next. And there was a meeting at the high-level officials, meeting at the White House the day after the 9/11 attacks, and Secretary of State Colin Powell wrote in his memoirs that he was in the meeting and someone said, all right, we're going to invade Iraq. And he said out loud, much to his credit, as so many Americans would soon say once they found out what this bizarre plan was, he said, invade Iraq? Why would we do that? Well, the answer to that started a few years before, and it started with the right-wing group, the Project for a New American Century. This was a think tank in Washington, D.C. It was established in 1997, closed up shop in 2006. It was established with this stated goal, quote, to promote American global leadership and to shape a new century favorable to American principles and interests, unquote. So to shape the coming century in the ways that would be pleasing to us. And leadership, their idea of global leadership, was not being a leader in the community of nations. It was, we tell you what we want and you fall in line. So this goal that they explicated there, they referred to as a new strategy for securing the realm, meaning remaking the Middle East under the hegemony of the United States, starting with removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq. And in one of the reports issued by the Project for a New American Century about increasing the American military capabilities was a section entitled Creating Tomorrow's Dominant Force, in which the observation was made that, quote, the process of transformation in the Middle East, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor, unquote. Who is behind that statement? The very same group of Project for a New American Century members who became key officials in the George W. Bush administration a couple years later and who pushed relentlessly for the invasion of Iraq following the 9/11 criminal attack. And these included Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Scooter Libby, John Bolton, Richard Armitage, Elliot Abrams. These people, especially Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Perle, had the ear of the newly, not really elected, President George W. Bush. And he declared at his very first meeting of his cabinet, quote, find me a way to go into Iraq, unquote. So even though, as intelligence officials later testified, there were many indicators throughout the month of August 2001, amounting to metaphorical red alerts blinking, that a terrorist group was soon to execute some sort of attack within the United States. And even though an Al-Qaeda operative had been arrested in the Philippines 3 years earlier with a laptop in which there was a full description of their plan to hijack commercial airlines and fly them into iconic American buildings. And this was passed on from the Clinton to the Bush administration. This is admitted. They knew that. Even so, the Bush administration did nothing about the alarming alerts in the weeks before the 9/11 attacks. But that's not really where I want to leave this subject today. What I'd like to contribute to today's reflections on the 9/11 attacks is a reminder of something that's been forgotten. That highly unusual experiential gestalt that prevailed in our country for many days after the attacks. To try to convey that mood after all these years, well, I went to my archival files and dug out an op-ed piece I wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle. It was published on October 8th, 2001, and it was entitled A Living Memorial. So this is just a very short excerpt, quote, "The initial shock and grieving after the terrorist attacks instilled in the American psyche a gravitas, a deep sense of grounding that seemed to slow time in our mad dash world and draw us into silent reflection rather than quick talk. Thinking felt as if it were weighted in our entire body. It refused to click into easy patterns as we sought to grasp the unimaginable new reality. In that palpable grounding the first week, we were all bonded with the dead and with each other, causing us to reach out to family and friends around the country in shock and loving support. It felt as if our suddenly having to bear the unbearable had delivered us into another way of being, one shaped by the trauma of immense tragedy and the movement into regeneration. Even mainstream commentators noted that the trivial concerns of our consumer culture seemed extremely irrelevant. We had entered a new time and a new psychological space," unquote. Well, I went on to propose that if we could drop down into this deep psychological space from then on when thinking and talking about important issues facing our country, that would be a living memorial to 9/11, a more grounded way of doing democracy. But of course, that's not what happened. We're very far away from operating with that deep grounding in our politics today. And really, the collective mood of introspection got hijacked pretty much right away. President Bush, those of you who were old enough to remember, went on TV and urged everybody to go shopping, or else the terrorists will have won by putting a dent into our economy this year. And he also made a formal address at the end of September 2001 in which he said that our response to the 9/11 attacks should be to increase the neoliberal so-called free trade, or else the terrorists would have succeeded. Well, even more, the Bush administration also hijacked the American public's questioning and coming to grips with the reason behind the attacks. Suddenly, several administration officials declared to reporters in interviews, "The terrorists are jealous of our hamburgers and hair dryers. That is, they're jealous of our prosperity, and that's why they attacked." And actually, what the Bush administration was sweeping off the table was the two reasons stated in a tape made by bin Laden. He said the reason Al-Qaeda executed the 9/11 attacks was because, one, American military troops had been stationed in the Muslim Holy Land, that is, Saudi Arabia, which was unbearable, and two, because of the treatment of the Palestinians by Israel, supported by the United States. And by the way, immediately after the 9/11 attacks, the Saudi government, I'm not saying, by the way, just to clarify, this justified the attacks. I'm saying it's kind of strange if you're really hit in a big way and have no idea why. It just seems a little odd. So those were their reasons. And by the way, immediately then after these attacks, I wanted to say the Saudi government did tell our government we had to get those American troops out of their country, which we quickly and quietly did, and which was hardly reported in the media and not connected to the demands of Al-Qaeda. And to this day, most Americans don't even know that was the main reason for the attacks. So the media went along with Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld making preposterous statements about how racked with jealousy the Al-Qaeda terrorists were. And then, of course, came the Bush administration's long selling of the truly insupportable idea that we should invade Iraq. And that took them from September of 2001 until mid-March of 2003, as they cycled through, if you recall, this series of feeble fabrications that Saddam Hussein's government was secretly importing yellowcake uranium from West Africa for their secret nuclear weapons program. Well, that turned out to be false. That a representative of Saddam Hussein's government had secretly met with Al-Qaeda operatives in Europe. That turned out to be false. Well, then an Iraqi nuclear weapons engineer assured the Bush gang that Iraq actually had a very secret nuclear weapons plan the UN couldn't even detect, UN inspectors under Hans Blick. Well, that turned out to be false. So I'm just wondering, aren't any of these lies at the highest level of our government pushing us into a war actionable? Anyway, when they started the war, which the Bush gang assured us would take only a few months, but which still goes on today, 13 years later in various shifting and unsettled forms, that's all because that handful of scheming, dissembling, macho megalomaniacs felt they could and should remake the Middle East to their liking with almost total ignorance of the dynamics there. Scores of thousands of people died because of it, and hundreds of thousands are horribly maimed for life in the United States and in Iraq and Afghanistan. Plus, our country is out $4 trillion. Well, at the same time, we've been focused on those two American invasions and wars during these years. The global climate crisis has been worsening. And I'm getting that same sinking feeling all over again, that the White House is simply not doing what so obviously needs to be done, nor are most other governments. We in the United States live in a petrol state, of course, so our government does not do anything that the fossil fuel corporations do not want it to do. And in this situation, the only thing that's going to get the attention of the politicians is for millions of voters to fill the streets demanding serious action on global warming and the resultant climate disruption. That's why the organization 350.org is organizing a huge People's Climate March in New York City a week from this Sunday on September 21st. If you live anywhere near New York and can get to the march, please do add your person to the headcount. This is hugely important. Don't leave this to other people. I'm reminded of something Gandhi said when someone asked him, well, this is just a huge task to try to get the British Empire to pull out of India. I mean, what could I as an individual do that would make any difference? And Gandhi said to him, yes, you're absolutely right. Nothing you could do would make the slightest bit of difference, but it is absolutely essential that you do it. And that's where we are on this. So jump in. You'll be on the right side of history, and you won't be alone. Some 320 buses and trains are going to be bringing people into the city, and the New York Police Department has allotted 26 blocks for the assembly area of this march. So be there, and please bring friends. Okay, speaking about what President Obama is and is not doing with regard to the climate crisis, there was a really excellent article in Harper's Magazine in the July issue in which the journalist who is with us today pulled together an overview of President Obama's record on climate action. That cover story was entitled, Promises, Promises, Can Obama Redeem His Environmental Failures? My guest today is Mark Hertzgard. For 20 years, Mark Hertzgard has written about global warming for such publications as The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Time, Harper's, Business Week, and The Nation, as well as appearing on NPR and the BBC. His latest book, Hot: Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, is both a father's cry against climate change and a deeply reported blueprint of how all of us, as parents, communities, companies, and countries, can navigate this unavoidable new era. Mark Hertzgaard, who has been called one of the finest reporters by Barbara Ehrenreich, is also the author of five previous books that have been translated into 16 languages, including On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency, and Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. He's a former fellow of the New American Foundation. He's the environmental correspondent for The Nation, and he's a co-founder of the group Climate Parents. Mark Hertzgaard, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Shirley.
Well, I'd like to start by orienting the listeners with just a short passage from your book. There's just so much to like about this book, which I'll get into, but it's this conversation you had where the man Chris West, who's the director of the UK Climate Impacts Program, a British government agency that educates governments, businesses, and individuals on how to manage the impacts of climate change. Oh, right there, I'm going, why don't we have a federal office like that? But anyway,
we do.
So he's at this conference, and he's talking to an executive from DuPont. And the executive from DuPont is, he says, told me all about the green initiatives that DuPont had launched, shrinking its carbon footprint, reducing its toxic emissions, and just treating the environment better in general. And jolly good, Chris West said, but is DuPont prepared for how the environment might treat you? He didn't know what I was talking about. I asked how many facilities this company had around the world. About 300, he said. I asked how many of them were located in floodplains. He didn't know. I said, don't you think you should? And then you comment, as we begin the second decade of the 21st century, every person on Earth finds himself or herself in the same boat as that DuPont executive. Like the executive, we are largely unaware of what is about to hit us, even as we congratulate ourselves on our blossoming environmental awareness. Oh, so, I think this book, Hot, is really something that will work for so many kinds of people, because through all this very solid and interesting reporting, I tracked the subject pretty closely, but I learned so many things I didn't know. But you run this leitmotif, the story of your young daughter. What is her life going to be like now? Because we've really squandered 20 years when we should have been doing something about this. So I wonder how you feel about that now. We're a few years down the pike. She's a little older. Are you feeling a little more hopeful? Or?
Well, I think there's no option but to be hopeful. Most of the great social change actors over time, whether it be Gandhi, as you mentioned earlier, or Martin Luther King, or whoever, Václav Havel, we have a piece in The Nation magazine up this morning, in fact, that talks that quotes Václav Havel about hope and the importance of hope, which is not to be confused with optimism, and that hope is optimism is thinking that something will work. Hope you do for a completely different reason. You do it because it's right, and you have hope that it will amount to something, but you don't know whether it will or not. And the key thing there, as I had the opportunity to interview Mr. Havel when he was still president of Czechoslovakia, and he said that the problem with a lot of people who think of themselves as very politically sophisticated is that when you suggest a certain course of action, they can always point out why it won't make any difference, and therefore they don't do anything because it's not the right course of action. And he says that the real weakness in that point of view is that, of course, they end up never doing anything because nothing ever seems like it's likely to work. But the one thing that we know will not work is doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And so hope compels us to act even in the face of uncertainty of what might be accomplished. And I think that is the piece I'm doing for, in fact, just today for the nation is about the People's Climate March on September 21st. And that's obviously one of the questions. Will such a march, in fact, make much difference to the political leaders gathered in New York that week to discuss climate change? Certainly, I covered the Copenhagen Climate Summit of 2009. There was a big march there. Anywhere from 60 to 100,000 people were at that march. It seemed very encouraging at the time, but judging from what did not happen inside the delegate halls, it seemed to have absolutely no effect on the leaders. So
right.
It's hard to know when we, I think you can never know in advance of a political demonstration or any political action, what will it lead to. But the one thing you can be sure of is that nothing will happen if you don't act.
That's right. I'm kind of reminded of the big demonstrations on mid-January 2003 against the invasion of Iraq, which the Bush administration, as I mentioned, was trying to hard sell at that point. And they were the biggest demonstrations around the world, all the big cities around the world. Everyone turned into the street. And 50% of Americans, according to polls, agreed with everyone around the world. We had huge marches here on that day saying, let the UN inspectors finish their work. You know, we believe what Hans Blix and the UN inspectors are finding, that his program of nuclear weapons has been dismantled since the Kuwait-Iraq war. So even, in spite of that, I know what you're saying, because Washington was able to just run right over it. But you had a phrase in your book that, of course, because government is set up to keep giving public money, government money to fossil fuel industries, and it would really require this new way of doing politics that would reorient that. And you say, they have to be pushed, quote, by intense, sustained pressure. And what I wonder about is, yes, we hope the march on the 24th will be huge, but I'm kind of wondering why there haven't been the formation of groups in all different sectors of life that there were in the peace movement of the early 80s, which, of course, was about the anti-nuclear, it could be called the anti-nuclear weapons movement. At that time, there were 30,000 nuclear warheads on our side, poised to go into Russia, 20,000 on their side, aimed at us. And so there was this huge people's movement over years to get rid of those nuclear weapons. And at that time, there was Citizens for Social Responsibility in every area. My next program, by the way, listeners, I'm going to have the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, Dr. Helen Caldicott, on the program. But there was also, my husband was in Book Editors and Publishers for Social Responsibility in New York. I had a high school friend who was in Manufacturers for Social Responsibility in Columbus, Ohio. It just seemed like there was a mobilization, everybody pushing the government from different directions. And I wonder why that hasn't happened in this even larger crisis, because that could be undone. This one, as you point out, we're into it. There's so much carbon in the atmosphere that it's not going to disappear. It may play out if we would suddenly lower the level right now, but it's going to play out for 40 years. So this is an even more grave situation, and I wonder why that kind of mobilization hasn't happened. What do you think?
I don't think that's entirely true, actually. I'm a little more optimistic about it than that, because from my own reporting, I see an awful lot of different social sectors getting involved here. From especially in the business world, which we did not see so much during the anti-nuclear movements of the 1980s. And there's a lot of youth movements. I mean, right now the biggest issue on college campuses across America, and has been for some years, is climate change, and in particular, most recently, the divestment movement.
Right.
Now,
Well, there's a lot of other things going on as well. Coming out of 350, which was only started a few years ago. There was no grassroots movement. I guess I mean organized. I know businesses are paying attention.
Oh, no, there's organized businesses, too. But on the 350 thing, I think, you know, what I was going to say is that, unfortunately, I think much of the mainstream environmental movement kind of got away from its grassroots roots, if you will.
Right.
You know, the mainstream environmental movement essentially emerged out of Earth Day in 1970 when there were 20 million people who took to the streets of this country. And at that point, since our national population was smaller, you know, that was almost 10% of the entire American public. And that definitely sent a message to President Richard Nixon. And we know this from the memoirs of his aides, that Nixon very explicitly decided in the face of that demonstration and the general social movement around environment that he had to, as he prepared for re-election in 1972, he had to take away the environment issue from his Democratic rivals. And so that was what led him to create the Environmental Protection Agency and champion and sign into law, you know, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Protection Act, these, you know, fundamental bedrock environmental laws that on paper, frankly, are still the most powerful, far-reaching environmental laws on Earth, copied by right. nations around the world. That only happened because Americans went into the streets. And so that
and also,
gave rise to the environmental movement. Let me just finish the
right.
point, please. That gave rise to the environmental movement that came out in the 70s, and they were able to pass things in Congress because the politicians were still afraid of what they'd seen.
Right.
And unfortunately, over the last 40 years,
and it wasn't
I think
a partisan
the environmental
issue.
Movement
it was bipartisan.
Has forgotten. The environmental movement has forgotten its grassroots roots, and so 350 has kind of brought them back to that.
Yeah, they do a great job. Okay, well, one of the things about the book, let me just say to people to sort of sketch it out. I mean, you really look directly at what our situation is now. You name that, and then you talk about your travels around the world to, oh, wait, let me back up. You name also this debate within the environmental movement between adaptation and mitigation. Adaptation meaning you better prepare for the bad climate events that have started coming and are going to keep coming. And the other side of this is, no, that takes people's attention away from mitigating the causes of it right now, cutting our carbon emissions. That's what we need to focus on. So I think you really make a good point in the book that actually encouraging people to get into adaptation brings them up to that wall where they see there's a limit to what adaptation can do. And we have to have mitigation right now as well. So I thought that was such an important point to make, and you made it by talking to these people around the world, what they're doing in terms of both adaptation and mitigation. And then, you know, particularly at the end where you talk about what we can do, I guess I'll save that till the second half of the program. But
yeah, I think that's a positive development, though, in recent years, is that the environmental movement and, you know, the whole climate field, scientists and politicians and so forth, that debate is now passed. Nobody would argue any longer that adaptation is not necessary. There are still the cranks who are trying to argue that climate change isn't real. But among the people who understand that, you know, climate is a big issue, everyone now agrees with what in the book I describe as the twin imperative of climate policy, which is that you have to mitigate as much as possible and adapt as much as necessary. That means that we're going to have to put in seawalls and to protect against storms like Hurricane Sandy. And here in California, where I live, we're going to have to figure out how to use our water much, much more efficiently because, frankly, the snowpack atop the Sierra Nevada mountains, which is accounts for about a quarter of our state's water, we're going to lose that snowpack over the next 40 years because of rising temperatures. So we've got to figure out ways to do all those sorts of things. But at the same time, if we don't turn off the heat, the source of the heat, and by switching to a low-carbon economy as soon as possible, nothing else is going to matter. There's only so much that you can adapt. You cannot adapt to 40 feet of sea level rise. You cannot adapt to 180 days a year of scorching temperatures.
Right. All right, we have to pause now for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on Altogether Now, speaking with my guest, Mark Hertzgard, author of the book, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Mark Hertzgard, author of the excellent book, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. His website address is markhertzgard.com. That's markhertzgard.com. So, let's talk about what's happening now and what could happen. You had the lead article in Business Week at the end of June about this comment that President Obama made. It was actually the same point I think Bill McKibben made a couple years ago in that Rolling Stone article, that the fossil fuel reserves that are on the books in the energy corporations needs to stay in the earth if we have any chance. And President Obama made the statement that, yes, two-thirds of the Earth's fossil fuels must be left in the ground to avoid catastrophic amounts of climate change. So you said if this were enacted, this is really the most important statement he's made about climate. So do you think that has any chance of happening?
Of course. Of course it has a chance of happening. It's going to have to be pushed through, though, by, as I said earlier, the sustained public pressure. But
yeah,
it certainly matters a lot that the President of the United States acknowledges that science. I mean, I think back to 10 years ago when we had a President of the United States and a Vice President, Mr. Cheney, who did not acknowledge the science. And that's part of the reason that we are in such a dire circumstance today, is that we lost 8 years there where not only was the United States not acknowledging the science, we were actually trying to hold back world progress. So to hear Barack Obama say that, I thought was a really, you know, literally one of the most stunning statements ever made by a modern president. And I should add, especially in light of the meeting at the UN that's coming up later this month, you know, there's no other head of state that I'm aware of who has agreed to this, who has said that, yes, we have to leave most of the fossil fuels in the ground. That is a revolutionary statement. It also, I have completely contradicted by his own policy. So
exactly.
The question
I was just going to say,
one thing for the president to say that, and it's another thing for him to actually do it.
That's right, because it would amount to a $28 trillion climate write-down, as you express it. He seems to be pushing in the opposite direction in terms of what he's doing because, Bill McKibben had a good article the other day I saw on EcoWatch about this whole framing of fracking fracking natural gas as being a bridge to renewable resource technologies. And he said, we don't need a bridge. You know, photovoltaic cells, the price of photovoltaic cells has dropped 75% since 2008. And if we put all this infrastructure in for fracking natural gas and exporting it, and he said part of the spiel now is, oh, this helps other countries. You know, if we poison and pollute every county in the United States that has a shale deposit under it, this will help other countries. It'll give them a bridge on their way to getting to renewable resource energy sources. So, you know, he seems to be framing it in a way that this is such a good thing we can do for other people. And, of course, fracking is doing so much damage. It causes earthquakes, pollutes the water, pollutes the air. I'm just worried about the gap between that, as you say, very exciting statement and the other indicators of which way he's really going, but we'll see.
Well, let's talk about fracking a bit. I've done a lot of reporting on fracking. I wouldn't be quite as categorical as you are about that it is, quote-unquote, causing earthquakes. That is certainly a very lively research topic for the scientists, but it hasn't been at all conclusively demonstrated yet.
Oh, I thought in Northeast Ohio that second report came out and said it had caused them.
It's very dangerous to say from one reporter and, you know, one study that one study proves things. That's not the way that science works. You really need a longer record of documentation. Now, I will say that on the water and air pollution side, that record of documentation is beginning to emerge. And we just saw last week from the state of Pennsylvania, and this is very interesting, the state of Pennsylvania has now, after dragging its feet and stonewalling for literally years, it responded to a Freedom of Information request on the part of the Associated Press. And the state of Pennsylvania has now divulged 243 documented cases of local water pollution near the sites of fracking wells.
Uh-huh.
So there you have what I would call real solid evidence, 243 cases in one state alone. So that said, the other really big question about fracking is, does it, and natural gas in general, is that better for climate than coal? And this is not to defend Obama or anyone, but simply to say that for years, many people, including the environmental movement and scientists within the environmental movement, thought that that was the case, that natural gas was better for climate than coal was, because coal is the dirtier, more carbon-intensive fuel. However, and again, the science is emerging and evolving. Once you look at the leakage rates of the natural gas, the fracking wells, and not just the wells, but getting the natural gas from the well all the way through the pipelines and into people's homes, there's so many leaks along the way, it's beginning to appear from the science, that the climate advantage of natural gas disappears. It's very likely, it appears now, although, again, the scientific evidence is not conclusive yet, but it seems likely that that there's so much leakage in the system that natural gas is not a bridge. And I think that it takes time, in this case, for politicians, including Barack Obama and many of the Democratic members in Congress, to catch up to science, because everybody wants to think that there is a solution there, that natural gas can be that bridge because it has all these other economic and geopolitical advantages. You know, it's certainly helped American manufacturing jobs, for example, over the last 10 years to have this massive amount of natural gas, which has driven down the price so much that you have manufacturing jobs recovering in Ohio and other parts of the Midwest. So, you know, it's a multifaceted thing. Politicians would like to believe.
It's driven
I'm
down
sure
the price
Obama
so much
would like to
that
believe.
That's why they've shifted onto an export market. Because they didn't expect it to drop that much.
Right.
But talking about the pollution, which I think is well established, you know, they've always said the fracking companies won't release what toxic chemicals they're putting in. They don't have to, since the Halliburton loophole in the 2005 Energy Act, Cheney slipped in, you know, removed the procedure called hydraulic fracturing from under the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. So we don't have to say what it is. And I thought, all these years of that, can't somebody get a hold of it and analyze it? Well, it was in the paper last week down here in Los Angeles Times that someone did. I think it was Jet Propulsion Lab. And they said, there's diesel fuel in this, you know, that they're pushing down into the water table.
Yeah. They've found out much more about what's in there. You're correct that Cheney did insert that. And as a result, at the federal level, fracking is essentially unregulated. But states are beginning to step up here and say, hey, you know, we're not going to allow this. For example, here in California, I think that fracking has basically hit a dead end, partly because of a very vigorous grassroots movement in various parts of the state, but also because the economics of this just suffered a major collapse when the federal government slashed its estimate of how much oil is actually down there by 96%.
Yeah.
You know, I think that fracking is probably not going to go forward now in California, and it looked like it was going to there for a while. I just did a big story on this in The Nation magazine. So it's something that I looked at very carefully, and I was actually down in Kern County near Bakersfield where a lot of the fracking has taken place.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's not to say that there's no fracking going on. In fact, I interviewed farm workers whose children are going to school in a public school that literally has three fracking wells within 100 yards of the playgrounds.
Uh-huh.
And complaining about their kids having asthma and so forth. So this is by no means over and done with, but I don't think that there's going to be the kind of massive expansion of fracking that many people feared just recently.
Yeah. Yeah, when they cut those estimates, oh, thank goodness, because Governor Brown, for some reason, would not put even a temporary moratorium on for the state of California with regard to fracking. But I want to mention this section where you're talking about the fact that we really need to not only cut the amount of carbon emissions that are going into the atmosphere, but also to try to draw down, extract some of the carbon dioxide that's already been put there. And this is where some people say, oh, these big geoengineering projects are the way to go. And you say, you know, I don't see the evidence for that. And a lot of scientists think it would even make it worse. And then you cite these projects that you've seen, you could call them grassroots agriculture and forestry, that actually accomplish getting more trees to grow, and so pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, and that really these are spread all over the world, all over the earth, this grassroots agriculture. And you talk about farmer-managed natural regeneration in Africa, that this restores the vegetation in degraded areas. It's very inexpensive. And then you talk about enriching the soil carbon with the biochar and also forestry, grassroots forestry issues. So I thought that whole section about geoengineering, GMOs, even nuclear power, you know, you said, I'm not ideologically opposed to these, but here are the studies. And you cited two organizations of scientists saying GMOs have never increased the yields, and here are the problems they're causing. So I talked last time about the article in The New Yorker by Michael Spector about GMOs, which I thought was completely one-sided. And I thought this was, you know, a way to be open-minded and yet name the studies that he wouldn't name. And I also thought the way you ended up with this positive, this is on the ground, this is happening now in African countries, and this technique could be spread. Do you feel there's sort of hope for this kind of modeling, spreading horizontally?
Well, we do need to, the basic point here being that we have to draw down carbon. You know, for 20 years, the discussion has been, well, how do we shift to non-carbon sources? How do we get off of fossil fuels? But that's only, and that's crucial, obviously, but that is only about how much more carbon we put into the atmosphere going forward. We're already up at 400 parts per million, which is way too high. So we're going to have to extract. We're going to have to draw some down. And, of course, we have a technology that we know perfectly well does that, which is called photosynthesis. And so if you are able to grow plants and trees, they will, you know, inhale that carbon and store it in their leaves. But the key then is that you've got to make sure that that tree or plant or what have you does not just die and decay and then release the carbon back into the atmosphere. You've got to take that carbon and store it underground. And that's what this new kind of agriculture that I was writing about in Africa does, which is to essentially take the and you can call it biochar is one word for it, but essentially taking the plants and leaves and then turning them into charcoal that you then put into the earth, kind of like a fertilizer, except it's largely made of carbon. Now, so in theory, that works great. But the problem with it is that it, at least so far, and again, I'm sorry, but as a journalist, I have to be a stickler about what has actually been proven scientifically as opposed to what people on the progressive side would like to believe. It has not been proven yet that biochar or any of these green agricultural techniques can work at the scale and at the economic price that would be necessary. In Africa, the story that I wrote about, you know, yes, it's working because the people there, frankly, don't have a lot of other options, and they're doing it at, they're starting from such a low base. These are people that essentially are facing the threat of malnutrition pretty much year in and year out. And so even a very small increase in their productivity, which is happening there, really leads to dramatic gains in nutrition. And it's a very heartwarming thing to see. You can go into villages where there used to be kids dropping dead from hunger, and now, although they're still extremely poor, the malnutrition rate and the death rate is plummeting. So that's all to the good. But in terms of doing this on a global scale, I've interviewed an awful lot of scientists in a lot of different places. And it certainly works in theory, but the scientists have not yet been able to prove how it will work at scale.
So they don't know. Yeah.
Well, they know it will work, but it's right now, and this gets to a policy question, if there were a price on carbon emissions, if we did not let people pollute the atmosphere with heat-trapping greenhouse gases for free, if we charge them for that and put a price on that, then that would solve, largely solve this problem. You would see the widespread adoption of biochar and other methods of basically sequestering carbon through photosynthesis. But right now, it doesn't make economic sense for the average farmer to do that. And I'm not talking about the big agribusiness farmers. I'm talking about the farmers who would like to do this. You know, you talk to the people at Rodale Institute, which is by far the leading green agricultural research institute in the United States. And even they, although they say, look, there's a lot of other reasons, good reasons to do this, but the carbon stuff, it doesn't pencil out yet economically. But that's where government policy comes in. You change the policy, you put a price on carbon, you know, these things are not impossible to achieve.
Exactly. And so many people have been pushing for it for so long, but not getting very far in our government. We just have a couple minutes left, but I want to ask you about this section in your book, This Was a Crime, you know, really naming this obstruction of what needs to be done. As I would call it, certainly it's morally criminal, but, you know, you can, I guess, a lot of ways make the case that it's legally criminal. Anyway, so you say, you know, the crime, in other words, continues. I believe that the rest of us should respond accordingly by calling the perpetrators to account, bringing them to justice, and prohibiting them from further imperiling our future and that of our children. So I think about that myself so much because it's still going on. So it's a message that you can get away with it. You can obstruct, you can, you know, run these doubt factories of the climate deniers so that people like that woman in the Vintner you interviewed says, oh, some people believe in climate change and some people don't. So some people are taking action, some people aren't. You know, it's still going on because they haven't been named in any kind of wall of shame or hall of shame or anything. So, but what are your ideas for bringing the perpetrators to account, bringing them to justice, prohibiting them from further imperiling our future? Because it's such a broad range of people who are profiting from obstructing.
Yeah, I think actually things have improved somewhat since I published Hot 3 years ago. You know, I think, for example, I saw John Oliver the other night on television, you know, poking fun at the idea of, you know, that there's some kind of a scientific question about climate change. And he did it in a very funny way. And I don't think it's any secret any longer that it's a mass audience. That is a mass audience with a lot of young people in colleges.
Young people,
look, I mean,
that's
people
true.
We on the left, we can't complain. Let's not complain when our message starts to get through to the mainstream.
I'm not complaining. You were just saying earlier, it's just you know, in certain quarters. So I think what you were saying in the book, you were calling for not in any one quarter, calling for our country trying to, you know, somehow get this named.
Well, and I think also in the media, you know, Business Week magazine, of all things, you know, a business publication.
Right.
They just ran a story exposing how oil companies are funding these AstroTurf organizations in California to fight the
right.
pollution rules. So, you know, I think there's a lot that's going on there, and that the big climate march on the 21st is another way to do that.
Yeah, I'm so sorry we've run out of time. There's so much in this book, folks. It's called Hot by Mark Hertzgaard. Mark, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me. Everybody go to the march.
Right. Okay, let's move over to the Arts Corner and see what we have there today. Well, of course, for our poem, it's about climate change, and I've read this one before, but when it comes to thinking about the climate crisis, I mean, really, what could be more appropriate than Kay Ryan's poem, The Niagara River? This is from her collection of poetry, which is also entitled The Niagara River. As though the river were a floor, we position our table and chairs upon it, eat and have conversation. As it moves along, we notice, as calmly as though dining room paintings were being replaced, the changing scenes along the shore. We do know this is the Niagara River, but it is hard to remember what that means. For our song this week, here's one more effort to get you to turn out for the big People's Climate March in New York on the 21st of this month. This song was written in 1965 by Bob Dylan, so it's not actually about evacuating from an extreme weather event, but it works. You must leave now. Take what you need you think will last, but whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. Right. This is a live performance of Bob Dylan singing Baby Blue. Here it is.
vagabond who's standing at your door. He's standing in the clothes that you once wore. All over now, baby blue.
That was Baby Blue, sung by Bob Dylan. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on September 25th with my guest, Dr. Helen Caldicott, the international advocate for a nuclear-free future. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Let's really